the last time I was at Cholham and I gave a talk on philosophy, it was up in the older location, which, much to my disturbance, ended up on YouTube in about 6 to 8 different parts, and all sorts of strange things have come out of that. So I'm hoping that if you're going to record it, it's just, you know, just be a bit ragua about what we do with it. I'm going to talk about a subject tonight. I'm only going to talk because there's a whole thing going on at midnight. So those of you who are wondering, I'm only going to talk for 25, 30 minutes. But if there's any questions, then I'd be happy to indulge those. I'm going to talk tonight about a subject that is not for everybody. Not everybody's going to relate to what I'm talking about. If you feel a burning desire in your soul that tells you you cannot simply listen to one more word of what I've got to say, then please feel free to just walk out, because that would be the healthiest thing for you to do. Sorry? I'm about to say. I always talk completely contentless information for the first couple of minutes, just to arouse myself into a state of control. But the topic that I discussed with Yitzhak, because I only flew into New York last week, and I arrived in New York from the other side of the planet on Thursday evening at around 8 o'clock, so obviously by 10 o'clock I was in Cholham. And I ran into Yitzhak and he said, do you want to speak next week? And I said yes, and so I thought about the topic, and the topic will become evident. The topic is called The Exile of the Divine, which really emerges from an exploration of a very powerful text that I've been working with for the last 2 years. In the middle of 2010, they decreed upstairs that... I was about to say for whatever reason, but I know exactly why, that we would have to leave the land of Israel. We made Aliyah at the beginning of 2007 in a tremendous Zionistic Islavus, and then within 3 years we suffered what could only be described as a lifestyle collapse, and we were wandering around Israel in suitcases for a few weeks. But by this time, my wife was getting to the point where she would no longer be able to fly, because she was already 6.5 months pregnant. And I decided that we would have to leave the land of Israel. And I took on a project before I left, because I thought I wanted to take on something that would at least carry me through, as something to do if I have to live in the most isolated Jewish community in the world. Without my library, without my resources. So I took upon myself to translate into English the Tikkuni HaZohar, which has never been translated into English. Let me explain what the Tikkuni HaZohar is for those who are not overly familiar with that text. Everybody, I would assume, is familiar with, or at least has heard about, a book called the Zohar. The Zohar, of course, is the foundational text of Kabbalistic thought and Kabbalistic literature. There is, of course, and I apologize if I'm going over very, very simple, basic ground for people, but when you speak to an audience, you never know who knows at what level. So the Zohar has undergone a bit of an attributional polemic, meaning that there are two basic views as to who wrote it and when it was written. One view is, of course, that it is a product of the Tanaitic period, written by Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, who is a Tana living in the 2nd century, a student of Rabbi Akiva, and one of the major links in the generation that led up to the codification of the Mishnah at the end of the 2nd century. And, of course, as famously recorded in the Talmud, he majorly slagged off the Romans. And they were looking for him, and so he hid with his son in a cave, and it's a very famous thing. And the Zohar, as a massive revelation, is a product of that sojourn in the cave. That is the mythological construct of the Zohar itself. That's what the Zohar tells you when you emerge. But the point is that we do not have, and this is the other perspective of the attributorial polemic of the Zohar is that we have no evidence of the Zohar until the late 13th century in Spain. What is common to those two views that we can certainly rely on is that the Zohar was revealed, regardless of who wrote it, the Zohar was revealed in Spain at the end of the 13th century. The Zohar itself, of course, has become an incalculable influence in Jewish life and in Jewish thought. It wasn't printed until the middle of the 16th century, of course. The first printing was in Mantua in 1558, but by that time, the Zohar, over those 250 years, the Zohar had become canonical. In other words, the major view towards the Zohar was that, yes, this is the level, this is Tanaitic literature, it holds the same level as the Mishnah, as Braita, as Tosefta, it's there. Today that view is somewhat altered. Anyway, the Zohar comes out in 1290, and 1290, of course, is a phenomenally important year in Jewish history. Is anyone familiar with what else is going on in 1290? This is an important point. It's not a random footnote I'm making here.
1292?
No. Well, what happened in 1292? 1492. Yes, so we're 200 years before that. 1290. That's 200 years later. That's what we're saying. But there was a major expulsion in 1290. In 1290, Edward the First. York is earlier. York is over 100 years earlier. In fact, York is 1189, 1190, but this is 1290. This is Edward the First. You remember the film Braveheart? Yeah, with Mel Gibson. So he's the king in that film. He's a total prick. But he basically banishes the Jews in our first ever nationwide expulsion. It's not like we were strangers to banishment, you know, communities were expelled from here and expelled from there and banished and exiled, but this was a nation, all the Jews of England, bang, after 1290, it was illegal to be a Jew in England until
Cromwell,
exactly, and the famous letter of Manasseh ben Israel to Cromwell, and, you know, in the 1650s, and Cromwell never actually officially readmitted the Jews to England. He just didn't object, which was good for the Jews because they had no special conditions. They could just start coming back. But that's a whole other story. Interesting. If you really want to understand Jewish mysticism, you look at Jewish history, because it really is Torata Sod BeItgalia. It is the Jewish people being a projection of the divine into history. And the unfolding of all of these things, you know, how many coincidences can we keep seeing before we say there is something, there is a narrative here that is beyond explanation. Anyway, the Zohar is revealed in 1290. 1290 is also the year regarded by most historians as pretty much signaling the end of the Crusades. Once again, an important point. The Crusades had been a completely futile and utterly miserable project that had been going on since basically
1099.
Well, outstanding, because 1099, of course, is the capture of Yerushalayim, but 4 years before that already, when Urban II Pope stood up and announced it. And we count it from 1095, because 1096 is the year of the Akedah. You know, in our generation, when we talk about the Shoah, everybody knows we have an almost existential, because we still live in the shadow and resonance of the Shoah. That is for us this massive watershed, and exactly good word, and a spectre that stands behind us, and in its shadow we try to operate. That was the case with the Akedah. The Akedah was the complete slaughter and genocide of all the Jewish communities along the Rhineland by the First Crusade on their way to the Holy Land. And for centuries afterwards, this event was known as the most horrific event that had happened, the most horrific massacre that had happened since the destruction of, since Bar Kokhba. So 1290, however, is 200 years after this. This is the end of the Crusades. The Crusades is a massive... If you can imagine a generation in which there is a huge struggle between two totalistic, absolutist, global, aspirational religions called Christianity and Islam, who are having a massive clash of civilizations over the Holy Land, if you can imagine what a generation would like that would look like. That was a joke, guys. That's our generation. But that is exactly the case in 1290, in the 200 years leading up to 1290. When the Zohar begins with the words Keshoshana ben Achochim, like a rose between the thorns, it's talking about the Jewish people being at the center of that very, very struggle. And 1290 is the revelation of the Zohar. But 1290 is also important for yet another reason, because of the year 1240. And the year 1240, of course, is... this one you don't need to be a maven in history, you just need to know a little bit of math.
Which country?
What's the Jewish year in 1240?
What?
5,000. It's not fair. But I mention that because, not because I'm giving the same talk, but because it's relevant to an understanding of the Tsar. It's impossible to understand.
So it's 772 years ago.
Yeah, exactly. It's impossible to understand it's impossible to understand properly any Jewish textual phenomenon unless you understand historical context. The Tsar emerges at that time. And there's no definitive view amongst scholars if it was written and composed in the 13th century, who actually was responsible for that. There are all sorts of theories, and obviously Moshe de Leon is the most famous of those theories that was posited by Sholem, but since then there's been obviously a lot of work on that. The general consensus is now that he might have been the main figure, but there was a chug, there was a group of people, and the Zohar itself is more like a body of literature, and there are later strata of the Zohar. One of the later strata is a strata which belongs to the Raya Mehemna and the Tikkuni Zohar. They emerged, also in Aramaic, in around about 315. So they are part of the same body of work, but they are, the Tikkuni Zohar is a development upon the symbolic structure inside the Zohar. The Zohar, of course, introduces us to this phenomenal symbolic structure on which the whole of the Torah rests. This structure which we know is the structure of the Sefirot, that we can perceive the interactions of the divine with the world through our Adamic form, not because God has a human form, but precisely we have a human form because we are microcosmic packets of divine potential that actually reflect the Creator. So this shift in understanding, and of course the Tikkuni Zohar develops this further to introduce the very influential ideas of the existence of different worlds, and each world, of course, corresponding to a range of Sefirot. Those of you who are familiar with Kabbalistic ideas will know what I'm saying. Those who are not familiar with Kabbalistic ideas will be as confused as I am. But the world's idea, that this universe is actually, in a sense, only one of a set of emanated universes, and by all accounts, according to what we're told and what we can see, the lowest. So that's what the Tikkuni Zohar is, but what it actually is, the Tikkuni Zohar is a text, what is this strata actually doing? It is 70 discourses on one word of the Torah. That word, of course, being the first word of the Torah, the word Bereshit. So it's a deep exploration of the concept of creation. And it focuses, we're not actually even sure, according to the text, and commentaries discuss this, whether inside the narrative of the Zohar, these 70 discourses are being delivered by Rabbi Shimon before or after his death. Various elevated souls from Jewish history are summoned to this revelation to give over their understanding of the concept of creation. There's a massive this perush on the whole of Tanakh, and I've spent quite a bit of time in the last few years inside Tanakh. I wasn't a Zohar scholar when I took on this project. I'm still not a Zohar scholar. But my grounding in Kabbalistic understanding is more inside the Kabbalah of the Ari. So to revisit the Zohar and to see these concepts introduced into Jewish thought for the first time is incredible. I started translating the text, and it soon became apparent to me, well, that there is a major motif running through Tikkuni Zohar, which obviously, I don't need to spell it out, would have resonated with me personally, but that I felt was trying to effect a shift in consciousness within the reader about God. And every time, of course, that the Jewish people undergo a shift in their perception of God, it can only be a healthy thing. The Tikkuni Zohar is overwhelmingly concerned with the concept of exile, with the concept of galut. Bearing in mind, of course, and this is just a footnote, the linguistic relationship between the concept of galut and the concept of gilui, both of which are derivative of this very powerful two-letter participle, gimel and lamed, which actually together mean wave. And so revelation, like exile, is an ongoing dynamic process that, and I use this in Kabbalistic terms, that God goes through, that the Jewish people go through, that humanity goes through, that the individual goes through, a process of exile and return, exile and redemption, exile and revelation. And what was startling was the fact that not only, according to the Tikkuni Zohar, in a number of explicit places, indicate that the Jewish people themselves go through exile, but when the Jewish people are in exile, God is in exile, and that's an idea already we know from Midrash, that, you know, God goes into exile with the Jewish people. But later Jewish sources seem to want to ameliorate this idea with saying, well, not God, but, you know, the Shekhinah, the sort of divine presence, the innocent, always expressed in feminine terms, the engaged presence of God, that is really also the divine counterpart of the Jewish people, the Shekhinah. But what the Tikkuni Zohar is saying is that no, it's not just the Shekhinah. The divine itself, the essence of God in the world, goes into exile. And there are a number of texts, but I was going to, in the remaining just, you know, 5-10 minutes, because I can wrap it on for ages, but I thought we would actually go over a text. I obviously, this is the version I'm using, which is I used as my translation Kushta of Constantinople of 1740, but this is the edition of the Matok Midvash. But I just want to read you. I'll do it from here.
Has your translation been published yet?
No. Sorry?
Who's publishing it?
I don't know. I haven't approached any publishers. Let me tell you that I have worked in complete and utter isolation for nearly 2 years. In November, I had the schut and the opportunity. They were schlepping me to Hong Kong to give some talks. And I had a friend who had a wedding in Israel. So I got Hong Kong to pay me for the talks 2 weeks before I gave them. And I used that money to fly to Israel, where I raped and pillaged the resources of the National Library, of the Sholem Library at the Sifri Aliumit. And when I use those words, I really mean it. Like, I was like a madman in there, frenzied, and, you know, for 2 weeks. You can imagine what it was like. During the course of which, obviously, I had the opportunity to discuss things with colleagues who have the schut to live and work in Yerushalayim, including several well-known academics of both good and ill repute. And the general reception that I got, which was my source, this is, and since then I went back, and I went back to the Midbar and I sat there, and then a few weeks later I've got to haul myself off the beach in 100 degrees and bring myself to New York in late January. And what I'm discovering is that most people who are aware of Tikkun HaZohar are not even aware that it's never been translated. So it is a bit of an obscure exercise. I haven't approached any publishers because I haven't had the opportunity to yet.
Is it possible that somebody else is also working in isolation on the very same project?
And let's hope that let's hope they do a better job. So I just want to learn with you one short section, because this is really the most powerful section that illustrates this idea. Because, well, it's all very well midrashically to say, oh, gone to an exile, oh, that's very interesting. That's a nice theological idea, right? Deus exilius. But at the end of the day, it has a phenomenally important aspect for us as people trying to understand the continuous narrative of the Jewish people and its relationship to humanity. Even living in complete isolation, one cannot escape the observation that various sectors of the Jewish people seem to be losing their way. I don't know if that idea is reflected in this room or not. It's certainly the impression that I'm getting. And that humanity is in need of some sort of elevation towards divine consciousness. But in other words, we need to break through religion to allow it. And this is what the Tikkun HaZohar is talking about. The whole concept of God is misplaced in the world. It is completely misunderstood and is being abused. And that's what it means that God is in exile. But at the same time, because, says the Tikkun HaZohar, God is connected ultimately to the Jewish people through a covenantal relationship through history, and that covenant is manifest in three essential physical processes, which are, of course, Brit Milah, Tfilin, and Shabbat, two masculine, one feminine. And that this covenantal relationship means that the Jewish people will always be around. We'll be around at the end of history, whether we are well-behaved, badly behaved, arguing, not arguing. We are an ammanetzach. We are an eternal people because of our relationship, because of the relationship of the Avot with God. Not because of our merit, but because the merit of the Avot. But nevertheless, what we do merit is that each generation is a link in that continuous narrative.
Not because we are spread all over the world.
That's why we survive.
Of course,
that's also an idea. That's a view. That's not a view that the Torah would agree with, but that's a view. But you know what? It might actually be true. It might actually be true, but not inconsistent with the idea of divine protection. The divine protects the Jewish people by spreading them all around the world. Who am I to say?
Well, one is factual, the other is...
Yeah, we might discuss this in a moment, because otherwise I'll run out of time and we won't have actually learnt any of the text. I just want to learn this short section. This short section comes from the end of the second Hakdama. So the one thing that I have actually almost prepared to publishing level is the first volume of the translation, which is this two Hakdamot, one very, very big one and one very small one. The second Hakdama, which is the small one, will be familiar to a number of you, especially those who grew up in Chabad or who daven Nusach Ari, because the essay, Patach Eliyahu, is part of the Siddur for Erev Shabbat, or just before Shabbat. So you'll be familiar with that part of the second Hakdama. That's the part of the short Hakdama, and this comes from that section, but not from the section that you would be familiar with if you knew Patach Eliyahu, if you know what I mean. It's from a later section of that very short Hakdama. In fact, it's the very end of the Hakdama. And the Hakdama itself is not about Bereshit, like the rest of the book is. The Hakdama, the introduction, is a mind-blowing essay, almost purely on A, the concept of exile, and B, a war that is being fought, using the name of God as a weapon. And thirdly, a massive perush on the first perek of Yechezkel. But right at the end of the Hakdama, he's commenting on the verse from Shir HaShirim, the verse from Song of Songs, which comes from the fifth perek of Song of Songs. And the pasuk is, Ani Yishena V'libi Er, I am asleep, but my heart is awake. Of course, the Midrash famously saying, Ani Yishena Begaluta. But that's a much, actually, not the Midrash is not saying that, the Zohar is saying that. The Midrash is, it's talking about something else. Anyway, the pasuk is, Ani Yishena V'libi Er, I am asleep, my heart is awake. Kol Dodi Dofek, the voice of my beloved is knocking. Pitchili Achuti Ra'ayati Yonati Tamati, open up for me, my sister, my beloved, my dove, my perfect one. And Tamati, of course, is a unique word because obviously Tikkun HaZohar relates Tamati to the Pasuk from Echa, Tama Vonech Bat Zion. Your sin has been completed, O daughter of Zion. Lo Yosif Lahagolotech, he will no longer exile you.
Doesn't it mean innocence?
It does, but it also means innocence in the sense of completeness. It's the same word, but they're playing on that. Exactly. My perfect one, my innocent one. Yeah. But that's right. Tam means finished and over. It has a totally different meaning, but Midrashic, I mean, it's the same word. It's an interesting... Yeah. No, and that was, the point you're making is the very point the Midrash plays on. That's all. And then it says, open up for me. Sheroshi nimlatal, for my head is filled with dew. And the locks of my hair with the sprays of the night. But it's these three words, my head is filled with dew. What is the Hebrew word for dew?
Tal.
Shehoshi nimla tal. What is the numerical value of tal? Correct. Now, my nimla tal, what does it mean, nimla tal, asked the Tikkun HaZohar? Amar kudsha brichu, the Holy One, blessed be He, said, Ant chashivat, you think, demiyoma di itcharav be'maktusha, that from the day the temple was destroyed, da'alna beveta dili, that I went up to my house, va'alna b'yishuva, and that I went up and, like, you know, settled down, sat down, watched TV, had a martini, that I'm just like chilling out and relaxing at home. Love hachi. Not so, says God. Because I do not ascend to my proper location the whole time that you are in exile. And of course, because when we are in exile, there is an exile of consciousness in humanity. It is not to say that, you know, humanity owes us one. It's just that that is the role of the Jewish people, to find their place in the world, and we know where their place in the world is meant to be, but to find it and its purpose in the world, which can only be good for humanity and raise humanity to an understanding of what God could be. But we have to arrive at that understanding first. Harelecha simana, you have a siman for this. Sheroshinim latal, for my head is filled with dew. Now, the name of God in 30 seconds. You know that God is Yud Hey Vav Hey. That's the revealed name of God, the God that reveals in history. What is the numerical value of that? Correct. When you, however, write Shem Hashem B'milui, that means you are spelling out each letter, so Yud becomes Yud Vav Dalet. Hey is hey. Okay, when you spell it out like that, you have a numerical value of what? Well, there are four, because there are four different ways of spelling it. So that's why you have 72, 63, 45, and 52. But what we're concerned about here is the name of 45, which you call Shema. The name that, when you spell it out fully, has a numerical value of 45. What is important about 45 is that it is the same numerical value, of course, as the word Adam, meaning that it is the name most associated with the divine expressing itself through the human. In that sense, the final hey is spelled hey aleph, that is the full spelling of the final letter. The numerical value of hey aleph is 6. What therefore, if that final hey is removed, then what remains is 39. That is the tal. Take 6 from 45, the remaining 3 letters, yud, hey, vav, is 39. Is everything okay? Hey Shchinta v'galuta, the final letter Hey is the Shchina, is the divine presence in exile. Shlimu dila v'chayim dila ihu tal, its completion, its perfection is tal, is due. Ihu yud hey vav, that's yud hey vav. The Hey and the final Hey, ihi Shchinta, that's the Shchinta delo mechushban tal, that does not come from the number of 39. Ela yud hey vav de saliku atvu nuchushban tal, but it's yud hey vav which equals 39. That's the tal. That's the dew that fills the head. De yuhumali le shchinta minaviu de chol mekori nilayin, because it fills the shchinta with from the wellspring of all supernal sources, of all higher sources. The Tikkun Zohar, the Zohar itself, the Tikkun Zohar, and I'm winding up on this point, is revealed at the dawn of the millennium of the human being. I mean, already, what is happening? I mean, well, first of all, it's the sixth millennium. The sixth millennium is the millennium of Shem Ma, the millennium of the concept of Adam, because human beings were created on the sixth day. Each millennium of Jewish history is related to a day of creation. And so the sixth millennium is the millennium focused on the rise of the concept of the human. Already as Tikkun Zohar is being written, Dante is the spark of the Renaissance. He's a contemporary of that project, and the whole of humanity is about to undergo a tremendous shift in consciousness that is leading right up to today. And yet, the Zohar is concerned about the fact that the concept of God in the world is not complete, that it is dislocated, and it's dislocated all the while that the Jewish people are not fulfilling their purpose in the world. Exile is in a sense, a self-imposing, I mean, I haven't got time to go on about this, but if we see today that the Jewish world is being ripped apart by sectarianism, then we know that we have not obviously repaired the tremendous rifts and sectarianism that was happening at the end of Bayit Sheni.
I thought division was good. And we just saw that division throughout the world is what kept us alive. If more division, therefore we're going to be spread to the moon.
Depends how you define division. Depends how you define division. Anyway. I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm not disagreeing. But it's amazing that we even have groups that go by the same names as the groups at the end of the Second Temple. I mean, it's phenomenal. The Sikari.
Oh.
The Kanaim.
It's an artificial name. Come on.
Not Sikari.
It's an artificial name.
What's
Sikari?
The Sikari with the... That's a whole other thing. Sorry. Oh, they're the guys. They're the guys running around Mea Sharim, smashing in the windows of bookshops that sell books. Anyway, I understand. It's cool. No, I didn't mean to bring this into actualia so much. I want to keep it more abstract. I'm only trying to illustrate a point that the fact that we are discussing these issues mean that, in a sense, there is an exilic project still going on. And the purpose of the Jewish people in the world is surely to, obviously, as we know, I mean, you don't have to be a warm, fuzzy, ooga booga to understand that when the Nevi'im talk about Am Yisrael being Or Lagoyim, they mean Or Lagoyim. And that is the purpose of the Jewish people in the world, to not only transform humanity through concepts of social justice and through concepts of freedom, but also to bring the world to a higher state of understanding that the true divine only provides peace and freedom to the world, and the concept of Tal and the concept of Shechinta should be reunited speedily and in our days. There were obviously a few things that I wanted to add to that and a few deeper levels that I wanted to take it to, because the concept of the exile is not a place about where you are. It's not a physical concept. It is a concept in consciousness. And it's a concept in consciousness within the Jewish world that seems to be out of alignment. It's not that I'm coming along and preaching what that alignment should be. I have my own ideas like everybody else, but the first recognition is that in some ways, if we are not careful, we will actually lose our way. And then if we have to be brought back to a realization of our concept, it's not always to our liking. That's all I meant.
Can you mention your name again?
I didn't mention my name yet. Oh, you? I'm David. David Solomon. I don't have a title.
Can you talk a little about your relationship to exile? Because you brought that as a state of consciousness. Maybe that's where you find yourself by getting lost.
That is why some of the great spiritual masters in Judaism went through self-imposed exile. It's almost a mandatory condition of enlightenment in Jewish thought. It's the concept of exile. And the concept of true exile, which means that not, you know, I'm going to go and live in the Bahamas, you know, on a sabbatical of a year and a half, and that's going to be my exile. No, I mean an exile where you really don't know from day to day where you're going to be and what's going to happen.
Only on
an interpretive level. However, the Zohar mentions several times the concept of Ishmael and Edom. Edom obviously refers to Christianity. Ishmael refers to Islam. And it's impossible that they're not referring to that, because that's the world in which they're talking about. But the thing you were asking about now, that verse at the beginning of Song of Songs, it opens with that, but the fact that that refers to Islam and Christianity is an interpretation. That doesn't actually say that there. Christianity and Islam did not exist yet, but Ishmael and Edom definitely did. And Ishmael and Edom evolved into Christianity and Islam. No. It's Islam. Sorry. Please don't call me Rabbi. Every time someone calls me Rabbi upstairs, they go, ksh. Sorry? David. I was just talking about that. That it's not a physical concept, it's a concept in consciousness. But I didn't necessarily mean that a journey away from Judaism would be an exile. A journey away from Judaism could be a redemption, something.